urban Indians. And before talking about any Indians and giving any quantitative statements, you ought to say something about who is an Indian, and that's a moot question that nobody has the answer to. All sorts of definitions. You can have a legal Indian, which may be or may not be the same thing as what the BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs, would say an Indian is. That is on a tribal, officially recognized, federally recognized tribal roll, usually meaning having at least 25% Indian, quote, blood, unquote. Might better be genes. I remember having spoken to one of my colleagues at Haverford and spoke about red genes. A person had some Indian ancestry, and he said he liked that because he knew that his wife had blue genes, but he didn't know whether she was royalty or not. Her ancestors do come from aristocratic family in Scotland. She was sure she had blue genes. But then there are cultural Indians, people who are, to all intents and purposes, the way they live are Indians. And I know one such who is 0% biologically Indian, but he's devoted to being an Indian and understands what it is to be an Indian. And I would say he is culturally an Indian. And they're what some of the Indians call instant Indians, like myself, who you get adopted, then you're an Indian. Or you put on an Indian suit and you dance. There are Indian clubs in Europe who spend the weekend wearing costumes and dancing very authentically, Indian dances. I just read in one of the books that's on the table out there about Mad Bear Anderson, whose picture you'll see this evening, and a very interesting article about him. Appeared in Esquire, I think, originally. But the Tuscarora Indians were having powwows for the benefit of tourists who had come in, and he got all of the invited dancers to refuse to dance because they weren't Tuscaroras. And so when the time for the dance came on, there were no dancers. But in the wings, he had a group of white dancers, Wonka Tonka dancers, all white people, who danced Indian dances beautifully. And so he had them come in and dance just to show up his own people. And since then, the Tuscaroras have been learning how to dance so they can do it authentically and in their own productions. There was a talk in Philadelphia not so long ago, and the speaker, I guess it may have been Leon Cook, said that to be an Indian, you must be accepted by your Indian community. Well, that's sort of a circular definition, because what's an Indian community if you don't know what an Indian is? But still, usually it's pretty well know what an Indian community is, and if the people there accept you as being an Indian, then I would say that's a pretty good definition. And somebody else I heard recently say that only you in your own heart know whether you're an Indian or not. And so that's a definition. It's not a very acceptable one to some other Indians, because some people can claim to be Indians who they think should not. But anyhow, so it's a very indefinite statement as to who is an Indian. But if acknowledging these uncertainties, you can say that maybe there's something like 1 million Indians in the United States. If you mean some Indian ancestry, then I guess there's at least 10 million Indians in the United States. But and about 500,000 or slightly less who are federally recognized as being Indians, and maybe an equal number who live in the cities who think of themselves as being Indians, and there are probably an equal number of rural people who think of themselves as being Indians. That all adds up to 1.5 million instead of 1 million if you followed the figures, but still, it's that indefinite. So I think for general purposes, if you just think of, say, 500,000 federally recognized reservation Indians, most of whom are west of the Mississippi, of course, but we're not talking about them primarily tonight, but about 500,000 who live in the cities and 500,000 who live rurally. Now, in the East, it's all the more indefinite as to who is an Indian. A Navajo or a Hopi or something like that, living in a obviously Indian community, there's no doubt about who's a Navajo, or very not likely to be. But who is one of the Eastern Indians? Who are the Cherokee, for instance? Lots of people claim they're Cherokee or have a Cherokee ancestry. So who of all these people really would be a Cherokee, who haven't lived on the Cherokee reservation for 5 or 10 generations or something like that? There hasn't been a reservation for 10 generations, but still. You have to go back quite a few generations to get back to Pocahontas, and the first families of Virginia all go back to Pocahontas, so I guess you're about 1/256th Indian or something like that, and more than that, it's probably 1/512th at the most. Some of those people might on occasion claim to be Indian. Well, in the East, as you well know, Indians were evicted, exterminated, pushed aside. Their land was taken, so that there aren't so very many Indian communities. Now, there are a lot of Indians, as I said, and there are lots of places where Indians think of it as being an Indian community, but it's not corporately, tribally owned land, except in a few instances. And with Indians, place, land, is very important, both in their religion and in their social life, in their corporate life. They need to have a land base in order to have a community base, in order to have a relationship, in order to have an identity, and a language and culture and religion and many other things that go into being what you might call a honest-to-goodness Indian. And that has been obliterated in the East to a large extent. There are rather few Indian languages, so that it's much more difficult to say who is an Indian and for a person to establish a satisfactory feeling of self-identity here in the East. And it's a major problem right here in Philadelphia, where there are several Indian organizations established to give people a basis, a community, a feeling of Indianness that was otherwise missing. So they've organized the United American Indians of Delaware Valley, which at one time was anybody who claimed to be an Indian in Philadelphia who wanted to pay the dues, including myself, who wanted to associate. But they had their ups and downs and got sort of taken over by the Holloway Indians, so it's almost exclusively Holloway Indians. And there again, I might digress to say, here's an example. Holloway, what does that mean? There never were any Holloway Indians. There are a lot of them now. Half of them live in Halifax County, and half of them live in Warren County. So they take the Hal from the Halifax and the Wa from the Warren, and they're the people that live in Halifax and Warren counties. They're the Holloway Indians, just as the Amherst County Indians and the Persons County Indians. And there are several other groups of Indians that are identified simply by the county they live in. They probably all go back to the Powhatan Confederacy, one of those groups way back. But they have no language, and they have very little remembrance of history, and or other connections. And I'm a little on a digression here, but still, speaking about Philadelphia, there's also the Powhatan Indians of Delaware Valley, and then there's also the Indian Society of Pennsylvania, American Indian Society of Pennsylvania. Now, they, in their last newsletter, said that they had read in the paper that the Penacania, which means the Pennsylvania American Natives and Indian Associations. It's a newly formed organization of organizations, just so they can speak with one voice in Pennsylvania on political matters or any funding that might be going. It's not an association of, not a social association, it's a political association of organizations. They had said there are in Pennsylvania a large number of people who don't even know that they're Indian, and they ought to have a voice. They ought to know that they're Indian and speak up so that federal funds for Indian education could come to their benefit. Well, Press Tonopahoat, who's set up this American Indian Society of Pennsylvania, he says, all right, anybody like that ought to be sent to Penacania. Don't come to me, because we know what we are. They're all people from federally recognized reservations. They're on tribal rolls someplace. And so they're sort of official. BIA Indians and some of these other people are racial, to some extent, racial Indians, sometimes they don't get along very well together. I don't know, they're just as racist as anybody else. And they're all good people, but some of them, well, they don't want to be nobodies. Nobody wants to be nobodies. And when they get, when the census is taken, they're put down as non-whites. Now, in the last census, there was a provision for saying what tribe you belong to. So that was an improvement. And because of that, the census shows more Indians this last time around than did previously. Because, well, people were afraid to say they were Indian. They thought they'd be discriminated against in jobs or put them down socially or something. They didn't, if they looked white, they would pass for white and not say they're Indians. But often they weren't. In many parts of the country, there is no such category as Indian. There are not enough of them to warrant making out the forms in that way. You're either white or you're colored or you're non-white. And so a lot of, usually, anybody wouldn't like to be classified that way. They want to be classified as Indians. I said something about the importance of land. In one of these pictures, you'll see Helen Adequin. She is the president of CENA, Coalition of Eastern Native Americans. That's a new organization, just a year old. It is practically the one effective, active organization of Eastern American Indians, Native Americans. Headquarters in Washington, Louis Bruce, who used to be the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, is co-director of it, and they have a good staff, they have good funding, and so it's an active organization. She's the president of it. And she said to me, she couldn't understand how some of these Western Indians thought that land was important. She thought you could be an Indian without having any land. Well, of course, her people lost their land about 300 years ago in King Philip's War, and after which the Indians were in slavery, those that were still alive, and many of them were held slaves along with black people, and so many of the present-day New England Indians show their African ancestry in part. Some of them do and some of them don't. But whereas if you talk to a Western Indian, I think they would, almost without exception, would make a great issue of whether they had a land base or not. Well, of course, those with a land base, if you ask Brian DeLore and some other spokesman, would say they really are Indians. And they would really question whether Helen Adequin and many other Eastern Indians are really Indians. They may look Indian, and they may feel themselves to be Indians, but they don't speak any Indian language. They don't have any Indian religion. They've joined one of our Christian churches. They don't have any peculiar culture values of their Indian heritage, except having maybe an annual powwow, which is more to get money from the tourists than it is from to express themselves culturally or religiously in some such way. Well, in the East, there are, according to the census, about 250,000 Indians. That's east of the Mississippi River. But as I say, it's so difficult to say who is an Indian in the East that there must be many, many more people than that, maybe 2, 3, 4 times that many people who would think in their heart that they're Indians. Not having any federal recognition, to be sure, but think of themselves as being Indians. The Indian population nationwide is doubling about every 14 years. I don't know how it is in the East. Don't have any figures on that. But I also have figures that show that the population in the cities is doubling every 5 years. The Indian population in the cities is doubling every 5 years. And that probably holds for the East as well as the West. Economic conditions on the reservations and in the rural areas where the Indians are in the East are really back up on the ridges. They've been pushed out of all the good land, and they're back up on the hillsides and the ridges down south, so that they're in impoverished areas. And if they want to get ahead, they have to leave. And the population, as I say, is increasing so rapidly, they've got to get out. Their land base is not increasing. So they go to the cities. cities make a real problem for Indians. That is, if they're really Indians, by some traditional definition, where they would have different values than standard middle-class white values. Typically, Indians are not competitive. Typically, they're not well-educated to have jobs that will succeed in the cities. Typically, they have a feeling of independence, particularly the men, individuality and independence that makes it unacceptable to an Indian man to take orders from somebody else. And he doesn't give orders to anybody else either. He lets the other person have the same freedom that he expects them to give him. And so usually they get fired from... they're very likely to get fired from the job. One of the books that lies out on the table is Housemaid of Dawn by Momaday. Well, it's a novel, but it gives quite some insight into the way an Indian man feels, who just can't take it on the job. He's doing the job very well, but his relationship with his foreman is a totally unacceptable one to him, so he can't stick it out. And so they feel pretty much abandoned and lost in the cities, particularly the more traditional Indians do. That might not be so true for Indian who grew up around Harrisburg, where there is something of an Indian community, I'm told. I don't know how you'd go finding it, but I know one such person, and I guess I could ask him where some other Indians are living around Harrisburg, or near Towanda, or what is what I mean. Yes, it is. That is not the name I mean to say, but it's it'll come to me up near Allentown someplace. So there are some pockets through all these states where, and in Massachusetts and in Connecticut, there are places where a few Indians are living in somewhat in isolation, mostly. Such people as that would be better educated in the local public schools and would be better acclimated to, and the Cherokee Indians of North Carolina, they have pretty much the same culture as their neighbors who aren't Indians. And they would make out better, but more traditional Indian communities don't get along very well in the cities, generally. And they start at the bottom of the economic ladder. They may have a little more status socially than and feel a little more proud of themselves, perhaps. They might look down on the black people, I'll put it that way. They feel that they have a higher social status than black people, but there's no doubt about it. On an economic basis, the black people are ahead of them in their ability to make a go of it economically in the cities. Also in the cities, they don't have their own kind in sufficient number for the most part. Now there are lots of Navajos in Los Angeles. The census says there are 25,000, but according to the people in Los Angeles, they say there are 100,000 Indians in Los Angeles. And many of them are Navajo. So they would be able to have sort of their own community. They don't live closely together as they would at home, but they'd have enough people to associate with if they wanted to. But in many instances, many cities, and for many other Indian groups, they wouldn't have that feeling of mutual support. So there's grown what they call a pan-Indian movement, or pan-Indian identity. The people in Philadelphia think of themselves as Indian. They don't go around saying, I'm a Chickahominy. They don't go around saying, I'm a Eastern Mattaponi, or something like that. Most people that I talk to wouldn't know what they're saying. They wouldn't know where the Mattaponi live, or where the Nanticokes live, or anything to characterize them. So they say, I'm an Indian. It was interesting at a Fellowship of Reconciliation conference in Philadelphia in January. There was a panel of distinguished Indian speakers in the morning. Each one spoke of him or herself as being, I'm a Seneca, I'm a Cherokee, I'm a Quinault, or whatever that person was. But in the evening, when Philadelphia Indians spoke, they all always said, I'm an Indian. They didn't have a feeling of a tribal identity. And that's one of the things that weakens them. They feel the lack of, they sort of are jealous of some of these Western federal Indians who know who they are, so to speak, and the city Indians, particularly the Eastern city Indians, who have don't have that strong tribal foundation to give them self-identity. They lack it, and there's considerable jealousy between reservation Indians and non-reservation Indians. For that reason, but also because the federal money is going to the federally recognized Indians, the reservation Indians, and the Eastern Indians and the non-reservation Indians think they are equally poor. Actually, they're usually not equally poor, but they're poor, and they would like to get some benefits too. And there is an act called the Snyder Act that says that services shall be rendered to all Indians, as Congress may appropriate money. Well, If the Congress hasn't been explicit to say that this money is only to go to Navajo or only to go to Alaska or something or other, well, then it's illegal for that money to be spent for all Indians. But the reservation Indians don't like that. That would mean only getting half as much money as they're now getting. Equal amount would have to be going to Indians all over the place. And then you get down to that definition of who's an Indian. They don't like that. Pretty soon there are 10 million people who are Indians if there's money being passed out. I might have mentioned in Philadelphia there's another organization called the American Indian Defense Coalition, which is not entirely Indian, but in fact I guess it was really founded more by non-Indians, but any Indian around is more than welcome, and many of them have become active in it. It was really set up at the time of the steelworkers trial, and I guess it may well become active again if the Shenandoah suit against the Philadelphia policemen actually materializes. People here in the East frequently ask how they might visit reservations and get better acquainted with Indians. And that's a rather difficult and touchy subject because there are more students interested in Indians here in the East than there are Indians. And if the Indians were to take their time to respond to everybody who wants to visit them, they'd be busy doing nothing else. And I think some people sort of think that a reservation is sort of a Disneyland or something of the sort where you go in and look them over for amusement or something of the sort. But there obviously are places where you're welcome. Any place that has a sign out that they're selling baskets or something, the door must be open. You must be allowed to go in and talk to the people, and hopefully you'll respond by buying something. And there are churches that obviously you're welcome in a church. And you meet people. It may not be what your primary objective was, to attend the services of that particular church, although it may turn out to be very interesting. I've attended different kinds of churches, such as Mormon services on the Catawba Reservation. Mormons are very much interested in Indians. They have a thing about Indians. I guess you know, back in their mythology, I might call it, their Book of Mormon, it's, the second coming of Jesus in the Western Hemisphere, to meeting with Indians. And so they pay particular attention to Indians, and they have Mormon churches on many, many Indian reservations. They have powwows where they really want you to come, and they're standing around and not doing anything else. They're hospitable, glad to talk to you. The only thing is, just don't expect to ring their doorbell and walk into somebody's home and expect them to give you some time or want to talk to you. But they also have dramas. There's some, one up at Brantford, Ontario, every year, several times, and Cherokee Indians in North Carolina have this drama that runs all summer. I don't know how Indian it is anymore. I haven't seen it for many years, and I understand that there have been some modifications in the script to make it less offensive to white people. Modified the history a little bit to make it more acceptable. There are athletic events. Up in New York State, lots of lacrosse games and ice hockey. I get just about as excited about it as they do down here at the Philadelphia, as you may. The communities are really out to see ice hockey games and lacrosse games, and that means there are lots of Indians around. So if you want to talk to some Indians, they're a fair game on occasions like that. And there's some very good museums to be seen. The High Foundation, the Museum of the American Indian in New York, 155th and Broadway, and the Natural History Museum in New York and in Chicago, and Ray Fadden, who is a Mohawk Indian up at Anshiota, I'll show you a picture of him. Has a very fine little museum, the Six Nations Museum. This is up above Lake Saranac, so it's pretty far up in New York State. Of course, the Smithsonian Institution and the University of Pennsylvania Museum here in Philadelphia is very good. Lots of things. Practically all the state museums where there is an Indian history to be recorded have something about Indians. And at Harvard, the Peabody Museum, some very fine collections. And there are a lot in Europe, too, because many of the very first acquisitions of American Indian things, at a time when Americans weren't valuing Indians, they were fighting Indians, and they weren't admiring the Indian artifacts or thinking of them as being collectible. At that time, European visitors, explorers, scientists were coming here and making great collections. So some of the best collections, I haven't seen them to be really informed, but I think Copenhagen and Vienna, well, maybe some of you know better than I, but I'm sure there are very fine collections in Europe. A lot of other things. Last time when I was talking about Friends and Indians, I really didn't say very much about what the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting Indian Committee had been doing with respect to Indians, and I don't think I'll take much time to do it now unless in response to questions, but I suppose you do know of the long-time activity. Well, I mentioned Tunasasa School last time, but with the Kinzua Dam protest against the violation of the Treaty of 1794, the Pickering Treaty, and our worker, Walter Taylor, who helped the Senecas for 5 years or so. And we continue it on a social basis. And the Indian Committee in Washington, D.C. has maintained some contact with the Pamunkey Indians in particular in Virginia. And on an individual basis, other New York Indians, particularly recently in connection with the Shenandoah trial, they were largely Onondagas. And so Philadelphia Friends entertained them when they were down here, not only the steelworkers, but their families and friends. And we've also visited them on their reservation at Onondaga. And so we've had more contacts there. One of the young men was an Oneida, and one of them was a Mohawk. So it's broadened our contacts up in Maine also. Maybe that's as much as I... Oh, I'd like to say something about population if it interests you. I don't know. Pennsylvania is said to have 5,500 Indians, according to the census figures. In the east, North Carolina has the most, with 44,000, most of whom are called Lumbee Indians. Now, there again, it's a synthetic name. There didn't used to be any Lumbee Indians 50 years ago or so. But there's a Lumber River where there used to be some lumbering industry. And these Indians lived somewhere around there, and so somebody concocted the name Lumbee Indians. They used to call them Croatan Indians. Well, Croatan Indians didn't go over very well. It sounded like Crow, and Crow sounded like Jim Crow. And, of course, Crow Indians out west are perfectly respectable, but the Indians in the east didn't like to be thought to be sort of Jim Crow Indians. And or the Tan, they got nicknamed the Tans. And that didn't go over very well either. They didn't want to have too much of connotation of being colored people. So they call them the Lumbee Indians, just by act of Congress, which gives them no privileges or services, no federal or state services as being Indians. They're just like anybody else who lives in the area, but they have a feeling of identity because of their Indian heritage. There's some others, most of whom don't like this absence of any services, no benefits to being a Lumbee Indian, and very little status. So they say, our ancestors were Tuscaroras. We want to be called Tuscarora Indians. And so they're fighting the appellation of Lumbee and the designation, and they want to be recognized for what they feel they really are. Everybody thinks of them as being Indians down there. And they want to be called Tuscarora Indians. And hopefully they'd get some benefits under the Snyder Act. In New York, there's something like 30,000 Indians. Wisconsin, about 20,000. Michigan, about 17,000. Illinois, about 12,000. Florida, about 7,000. Ohio, about 7,000. Those are census figures. The state with the most Indians is Oklahoma, with 97,000 about. Actually, undoubtedly much more than that, but as I say, those are census figures. You may be surprised to know how many Indian tribes still think of themselves, or groupings, or people who recall their Indian heritage identity. I don't think I'll read the whole list, but there are 66 names of extant groups of Eastern Indians. And that's far from exhausting. In the just in the current census, there are many names that aren't on my list. But I think they have too many names. They have two Mattaponais, just spelt differently. They have two Pamunkeys, only just spelt differently. And so there are some insignificant differences. But here's a list of 66 currently recognized groupings of Indians in the east of the Mississippi River. So I'll be glad to respond to questions as that you may have, but otherwise I think most of my presentation will be on the slide.
Yes, officially, who is make some kind of a definition of that, you can't do it. As I say, you may be a person who is on a roll for a federally recognized tribe, therefore you are officially a member of that tribe, you're verified Indian. You may be somebody that's recognized by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. You may be a person who can prove that every one of your ancestors is Indian, some of whom aren't Indians. You can be an Osage Indian, have 100% Indian ancestry, but you're not on the roll, therefore zero Indian. You can be a Canadian and marry a non-Indian, you're there. So facto a woman, married a non-Indian, so facto not an Indian anymore. Your ancestors are going to be 100% Indian, but you're not an Indian. And the other way around too, you may be on the rolls and have 0% Indian ancestry. There's some Osage Indians who have 0% Indian ancestry, but they're on the rolls. They got in because they married an Indian or something or other, not the inheritance. So there are all kinds of definitions, most of which are unsatisfactory.
What's the difference between the definition of
an illegal alien? I don't think you can say. There isn't any legal definition. You have to pass a law on the subject to be specific. You have to have a court case. Mm-hmm. And there are plenty of people with black ancestry who have sufficient non-African ancestry so they don't look African and they pass with white. On the other hand, a brother of the same family might look quite Negroid and be considered to be black. Ancestry would be the same with what people take them to be. And you go to another country like Mexico, you can be an Indian one day and a white man the next day, depending on which place you're with, which group of people you're associating with, what job you hold. If you get in the army, you're not an Indian anymore, because it's against the law for an Indian to be in the army. If you get in, then you're not an Indian anymore.
You mentioned the Indians have difficulty getting along in the city because of their, I guess, past culture. Is anyone doing anything to help them survive in the
Yes, a great deal has been done for it. Almost all the schools are working at it. Almost all the churches are working at it. Almost all the government agencies are working at it. And almost all the unions are working against it. They don't want to be a...
Right, this is what I'm wondering. Is there a possible way, is anyone going to help them to hold on to their old culture and survive?
Well, yeah, there are some schools that have Indian school boards, and most of all those people want an education, but they want an education under their own control, with their own say-so, as to... Without, for instance, Navajo Community College has a training program for medicine men, among other things. And they teach their language and how to read and write it, and they teach their heritage and their legends and their heroes. So, a great, I wouldn't say a great deal has been done, but something is being done, and more ought to be done. Indian schools ought to be under Indian control, but they're not, except for a few exceptions. On the other hand, I don't think it's proper to say let's try to freeze them and prevent them from making choices that might be changed. Well, we often prevent Indians from making any decisions and say you've got to be just like your grandparents were. We're going to change it. Want, for anthropological reasons, we want to maintain a pure colony of the way it used to be. That's a zoo, so to speak.
But right now,
there's
mostly empty.
It's directed
from the change.
Join the mainstream and become, yes, that's the typical. Well, if you have any questions about places, I can answer them right now before we move on to the next slide. But of course, we're talking about east of the Mississippi River, and there are state reservations in Maine, there are Passamaquoddy and the Penobscot, and there are a few in Connecticut, very, very small. And there are a couple, three maybe, out on Long Island, Shinnecock, Kuskokwim, and Montauk. In New York State, the Iroquois, six nations, the Senecas over here, Tuscaroras, more Senecas, Oneidas have a very small place, Onondagas, and Mohawks. Cayugas live with the Senecas. Then down in Virginia, there are two reservations, the Pamunkey and the Mattapani. And this is a federally recognized reservation, Cherokee, and in Seminoles and Miccosukee have several spots. They're federally recognized. The Senecas are partially federally recognized. They are not allowed to sell their land except with federal approval. And the Holland Land Company has the first option on the land.
I think that's about it as far as the other. There are other communities that are recognized as Indian communities, but they have no state recognition or no federal recognition. In other words, they pay taxes. Except down here in Mississippi, the Choctaws. The Catawbas in South Carolina, that'd be about there, I guess, used to be a federal recognition, federal reservation, but that was terminated a few years ago.